Would you please join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Bart from Mission Viejo.
My name's Bart, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, I don't know what I'm going to say, but I think that I can do what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I was thinking earlier that I remember the first drink of beer I had, and I remember the first drink of alcohol I had, and I do not remember the first green bean I ever had, and to paraphrase a friend. The first beer I had was when my parents were drinking beer. They were college. My father was a college professor, and I would take the empty beers down to the basement and pour them all into one and then drink it. And I was about 7. I didn't know then that my relationship with alcohol was different than other people, but I knew that I was different. I knew that I was special. I was cute. I had curly hair. My parents continued to tell me how cute I was. I was an only child until my goddamn brother and sister came along. And that was about 7 years, so it was a perfect 7 years. My first drink of alcohol, hard liquor, was in my grandfather's liquor cabinet. And I was about, I don't know, maybe 11. And I remember it as if the day was yesterday. I remember the sun coming in the window. I remember going to the liquor cabinet. I remember getting the bottle and drinking it. And I remember that thing in our stomach, you know, where all of a sudden I felt not so different, not so special, not, you know, in a bad way, but just really good. And, you know, that started my journey. And my journey, you know, took me to some very strange places. My problem, of course, was not only alcohol. My problem was relating to the world. And to say that I suffered from a lack of self-esteem, I think would be somewhat of an understatement, okay? I kept trying to prove that I was okay. And, you know, it's really hard to prove you're okay when you don't feel okay. I mean, it's damn near impossible. So I kept on trying to do that, and the people around me started reacting to my trying to prove that I was okay by using them, abusing them, stealing from them, etc., etc. You know, people don't normally like that. So, like a lot of us, I wind up isolating myself in most of my life. I have one friend from high school, and he drank the way I did. And he's now sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, too. Thank goodness. And so we reconnected. But I don't have any other friends because I would throw up on them and I would steal their car and I would try to go to bed with their girlfriends. And, you know, I had no real boundaries. You know, there was somewhere in one of my therapy sessions when I realized my parents had not given me any boundaries. And that at, you know, 36 or something, I'm trying to figure out about boundaries. It's a little late to do that, you know. If you got kids, by the way, they really like boundaries, all right? And so I didn't have any boundaries, and I didn't know, and I was just sort of flopping around trying to figure out what to do. I had an opportunity to go to college. I didn't do very well in school, but, you know, I flunked my entire sophomore year. Well, that was after I ran away from home. And it sounds so romantic, but I went to live with my grandmother and my aunt and uncle, you know, and my grandmother thought I was a saint, you know. So I went to live with them, and I flunked my entire sophomore year, but then I went to summer school, and I got out of high school, and I could pick a college that I went to. I could go to anywhere in the country. There were a couple, and they needed students desperately. It's not like now. So I went, well, I'm going to New York. I'm going to Long Island University. You can drink at 18 in Long Island University. You couldn't drink anywhere around where I was until you were 21 otherwise. So I went to school in New York. And like most of us, I went through 4 roommates until I found one that drank like me, Jack. He drank like I did. And that was where I discovered that I was most comfortable with people like me. And I used to go to a place called Rose's Bar and Grill. And it was it's an institution in New York, or was. And it is open 365 days a year. It closes half an hour between 5:30 and 6 to sweep up the sawdust on the floor and put new sawdust down. Okay? And at the time, it was 25 cents for a shot and 20 cents for a beer. So we would do, I would do Boilermakers, you know? And Jack and I, we discovered Typhoon Fifths of sake, you know, which are like this big, you know? And we would think we were really cool, you know, and we would drink them, and, you know. So we drank a lot. And I abused people. And I was not asked to come back to the college, needless to say. And so I decided that I would go up and I would play guitar, and I'd go up to this place that my aunt and uncle had up in Cape Cod, and then I would play guitar and sit on the beach. And unfortunately, they turned out to be there. And they said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. And they said, well, why don't you take care of your military obligation? And I went, what military obligation? I have no military obligation. And so the next thing I know, I'm in Buzzard's Bay, going into the military. And as usual with my life, I sort of stumbled through stuff. And I went into the Coast Guard. And I wondered, because I thought, well, I'll be on a boat. I'll be in Cape Cod. It'll be fun. It'll be cool. And they said, you can't come into the Coast Guard. You've got glasses on. And I said, well, shoot, that's no good. So the next door down was the Navy. And I've always been grateful that it wasn't the Marines or something like that. But the next, because I would have gone. I know, you know, I don't know what to do. You know, somebody's telling me what to do. It's like a guy one time said, if he went to another city and he was standing on the street corner and somebody came and said, you're in my spot, he'd move. You know, because that's the kind of self-esteem we don't have. So anyway, the next door down was the Navy, and they said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to be a journalist. I want to be a poet, was what I really wanted to say. But I didn't think they'd take them. And they said, well, can you type 40 words a minute? And I said, no, I can't type. And they said, what else do you like? And I said, well, I like people. And they said, well, why don't you become a corpsman? And I went, what's a corpsman? And they said, well, it's a, you know, it's a medic. It's kind of, I said, oh, that sounds cool. Not cool. Needless to say, I mean, other than the fact that throughout the rest of my life I had that as a career. But at the time, all I knew was that I was going through training and stuff like that. And then I had, you know, wanted to get out of the country, and Vietnam sounded like a good idea. So, you know, that was back in 1965, and we, you know, I was a John Wayne kind of kid. So I thought, well, you know, I'll go to a foreign country. It'll be very exciting, and I'll come back with some medals, and I'll get laid a lot. You know, that was my idea. You know, this alcoholic thinks really well when they're drinking. You know. So I went to Vietnam, and I, as a medic, and volunteered, and I worked in a, I wound up volunteering for this Vietnamese hospital, because our hospital got blown up, and so a bunch of us, about seven of us, they asked for volunteers to go to Guam while they rebuilt the hospital, and I went. No, I've been long enough to know that I wasn't going to volunteer for anything. So I started working in this Vietnamese hospital, and I'm, you know, like 19 years old, and I'm, you know, I'm operating on kids, for Christ's sakes, you know, and doing stuff like that I don't even know how to do. I mean, I look back on it today and I go, how the hell did you do that? You know, like so many things in my life, I don't know how I did it. To cut to the chase, I wound up, because of something that I did to somebody, staying there for 2 years, and I did not drink much when I was there, except on R&R. And it is historically true that alcoholics in a war situation will often not drink the way they did before or the way they did after. And that was my case, because I was terrified that if I drank, I'd get drunk and I wouldn't be able to take care of somebody that was coming in and needed to be taken care of. Working in an operating room, for God's sake, with blood everywhere. And being drunk in an operating room is not my idea of fun. But I did discover nitrous oxide. Great drug. Just heard about somebody dying from it again the other day. But for me, it was perfect because I could get really loaded and then get, once you stop using it, you get straight really quickly. You don't have to hang over and any of that stuff. And you start rhyming shit and everything, and it's just really, it's really a lot of fun. So I discovered that there, and I brought that little habit home. And when I got home, I started working in this hospital in Alexandria, Virginia. So I'm working there, and my supervisor comes in, and I'm toking on this nitrous out of this tank. And I said something like, "Hey, what's happening, baby?" And she said, "Get out of here," or something. And I forgot. So I came to work the next day, and all my black friends are going, "What are you doing coming back to work? You're fired." And I said, "What do you mean I'm fired? Why would I be fired, you know?" And so they kicked me out, for Christ's sakes. So what do? I go to California. I have a car. I have a 57 Chevy. And I figured, well, I'll drive to California. With a couple friends said, "Let's go to California." So we came to California. Brought 2.5 pounds, a kilo of marijuana to California. Really smart. Again, that thinking brain. And to cut to somewhat of the chase, what happened was that my life continued to go on a downhill slide. I continued to work. I'd keep a job for about a year, you know, and then I'd leave, or, you know, somebody would piss me off, or I'd piss somebody else off. And I started, I got a job, I decided I was going to get straight. I had a girlfriend, we had a baby, came on one night, drunk out of my mind, beat this poor little girl up, 2 years old, and came to the next morning, and the lady was packed and on her way back to Alaska with that little girl, which at the time I didn't appreciate. I have since come to realize it was the best thing, one of the best things that ever happened to me or them. But at the moment, I was upset. So I went to San Francisco, and I decided to find a job, and I got a job in a VA hospital. And I told the guy, I said, "You know, I had a problem with nitrous oxide before, but I'm okay now." You know, and he said, "Oh, that's wonderful, good. And, you know, here, this job is here." So, you know, I was there, and I had made myself a promise I was not going to use it again. And I'm drinking all the time, but I made myself a promise I wasn't going to use nitrous. Well, it was 2 weeks. And I wound up getting bad enough so that the snakes were coming out of the wall socket, out of the, you know, the ventilation ducts. And the people were sneaking around looking at me through the window and stuff like that. And I got them so paranoid that I just, you know, said, "I got to stop this." So, you know, I had wrecked my cars, all my cars. I'd wrecked them, so I couldn't drive anymore. But living in San Francisco, you don't have to drive. I had this kind of triangular thing where I had work, my apartment, Dizzy's Bar and Grill, and the 19th hole, and the liquor store. And they were all in this kind of contiguous area, so I could sort of make it from one to the other. And there were a couple of stories about kind of getting to the end of my drinking. One of them was one time I had to go to the liquor store at before 2 when they closed. And I got there at 1:45. I had like $1.99 or $2.50 or whatever it was, and I was getting triple jack. I don't know if any of you have ever drunk triple jack, but it's a god awful drink. It's 20% alcohol. That's all I could afford. It was like $2, and I drank Thunderbird when I couldn't drink triple jack. But triple jack was kind of classier than Thunderbird. I didn't feel like telling people I was drinking Thunderbird, but triple jack sounded kind of triple something. It was kind of bigger, so it was good. So I went into the liquor store, and I got this bottle of Triple Jack, and I walked out, and the bottle dropped to the ground, and it broke. And I, honest to goodness, got down to see if there was any left in the thing, because I didn't have any booze at home, and they were closing, and I had no more money. And fortunately, I there wasn't. But I it went through my mind, I can't hold my liquor. It was a great metaphor. I didn't know it at the time, but it was a perfect metaphor for what was happening. The next thing that happened was I drank at Dizzy's Bar and Grill, and he would take, and the reason I drank there was simple. He'd take my checks, Okay. Thank God he saved them for me after I got sober and gave me one night's worth of 20 checks. 20. And I watched my signature. You can read my signature. I'm very proud of my signature. Now I kind of take it. I do not scrawl my signature. You can actually read my name. But at the time, I was trying that. And by the end of the night, it was like one line that went on. And so I'd go to Dizzy's, and I was there with this guy, and he was drinking this snifter of brandy, and it had like about a cup of brandy in it. And he's drinking this brandy, and he goes, I said, aren't you drinking last? He said, oh, I said, he said, I'm drinking, but I'm no different when I'm drunk. And in my mind, something happened in my mind, and in my mind went, that's bullshit. That can't happen. And then I went, hey, wait a minute. I'm no different when I'm drunk either. And I went, why the heck is that? And I went, because you're never sober. Because you're never sober. You know, one of the things I have discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous is it's impossible for me to know why something happened or how it happened until I don't do it anymore. So I'm flummering around, you know, like we do, and all you know, I went to the Center for Special Problems. Eh? I'm special, right? I told you already. I'm special. So I thought, well, this is made for me. It's a Center for Special Problems. I have special problems. You know, I'm suicidal. I've alienated everybody in my life. Nobody wants me around anymore. I can't stop drinking. I'll go to the Center for Special Problems. They'll fix me. It happened to be a therapist, interesting guy, by the way, a guy named Karpman, who invented the Karpman triangle of relationships. Really cool. Look it up sometimes. It's great. Anyway, I went to this group therapy thing with him, and I thought, I'll tell the truth. I'll try that, see what happens. And I said, I think I might have a problem with alcohol. And they went, really? And they said, how much do you drink? And I went, what do I say? And I thought, I drink a bottle of wine a day. Now, I knew that they were going to think rosé when I was thinking a gallon of Gallo. Okay, because there's no way I'm drinking rosé. It's 12%. You know, I'm drinking Triple Jack Thunderbird, which is 20%. I know how to drink. You know, I'm not drinking that cheap shit, you know, no matter how much it costs. It's only 12%. So they say, went, oh, isn't that interesting? And they then they said, where do you drink? And I said, well, I drink in the park. Golden Gate Park where I live, where I was, not, when I was near where I worked and near where I lived, I'd go out on this golf course and you could look over the Golden Gate Bridge and I'd get plastered there, you know, and kind of pass out. It was gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous country. So they said, where do you drink? And I said, well, I drink in the park all by myself. And they went, what? Don't you drink with your friends? And I went, oh boy, these people don't get it. I'm never coming back to this place. They don't understand. There's no way. They don't understand. They think I'm weird. I know I'm weird. I know I'm crazy. But these people are really crazy. And I want nothing to do with them. I still want nothing to do with them, by the way. So, one day I come home, and I have a house with two cats. Still have a house with two cats. I had an apartment there with two cats. And two cats, by the way, that when I left them to go out somewhere and I wouldn't play with them for a couple of days or a weekend, they'd tear pictures. They'd take a picture out of a file of pictures I had of me, and they'd chew around the edges and they'd leave it in the middle of the room. I swear to God, they knew. I came home and I turned the radio on. And I was on a radio station I'd never listened to before. And it was an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It was the beginning of an Alcoholics Anonymous thing. And I had never listened to this radio station before. And I sat down and I heard a discussion meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you were talking about me. You were talking about being afraid. You were talking about being alone. You were talking about how alienating yourself from all your friends. And I knew that there was some kind of answer. See, I knew I was crazy. There was no question about that. I just didn't think there was any hope for me whatsoever. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, the Center for Special Problems was not going to work. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Believe it or not, there was a guy named Bill on the other end of the line. And Bill A, who's still sober, shared his experience, strength, and hope with me. And did not tell me what to do. Now, I'm sure the rest of you are different. But when I get told what to do, I almost always do the opposite. You know, I once told my mother that if she told me to put on rain boots because it was raining, I would not do it, just on general principle. I wish I could tell you that after 36 years of sobriety, I've changed. I haven't changed. I'm still that way. Okay. So I listened to Bill, and he said, "You want me to pick you up? I'll take you to this meeting on California Street." And I said, "No, I got here by myself. I'll get to the damn meeting by myself." And I took the bus or walked or whatever it was, and I got to the California Street in a church like this, only it was in a basement, and stood outside, watched the women walk in. Went, hey, wait a minute. There can't be any women alcoholics. What the heck, you know? That doesn't make any sense. You know, I knew I'm a very smart person, as you probably already have guessed. I knew nothing about alcoholism. Not a thing. Before I forget, just one more thing. I worked at a VA hospital. I was coming home for New Year's. This happened around New Year's, 1972, 73. And I was coming out of the hospital, and there was this guy who had no esophagus from alcoholism. And he had a tube that went into his stomach. And I'm coming out, and he says, "Hey, Doc, you going out? You coming back?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm coming back, probably another day or so." He said, "Buy me a bottle of bourbon. Buy me a bottle of bourbon." And he was going to take the bourbon and pour it in the tube that went out in his stomach. And I knew that was me. I tried to look down on him. I couldn't look down on him. I couldn't look at him as different. I don't know why. Believe me, I don't know why. But I got it. It was one of those things I went, that's where I'm going. That's where I'm going. That's where I'm going to end up. So I called that Bill, and I went to the meeting, and I'm the youngest person in the meeting. 29 years old. Everybody else is all dressed in suits and ties, and they're all 40 and telling me they drank more, spilled more on their tie than I drank, that kind of stuff. But I kept coming back, and the reason I kept coming back, first of all, was because everybody was laughing. And that laughter was like somebody shot me with heroin. I couldn't believe how excited I was by that laughter, because I hadn't been laughing for a long, long, long time. So that was the first thing that got me back. The second thing was, the second meeting I went to there was a 19-year-old female. And I went, I'm liking this place more every day. And the rest of this is about what happened and what it's like now. And I just want to warn you, I have done everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous except pick up the first drink. I have not had a drink in 36 years. All right. But I have done everything else wrong, quote unquote. I look at my friends that have been married for 30 years, and I look at them like they're from Pluto. Okay? I have issues with relationships, I don't know whether it has to do with Vietnam or what, but I have issues with it. I love people, and people love me. But my Alcoholics Anonymous career has been interesting, to say the least. What happened, and the reason that I'm here today, is because I understood Alcoholics Anonymous in 2 weeks. You can look at it does not take a rocket scientist to figure out where Alcoholics Anonymous comes from. That, the religious precepts, the idea of service, of confession, etc., etc. So I got Alcoholics Anonymous. I grokked it, as they used to say. So at the end of 2 weeks, I get a call from a psychologist who works in alcohol rehab who needs my help because he's drunk and he knows that I know how to help him. Well, I'm not going to follow anybody else's directions. I'm not going to go with anybody else. I'll go by myself. I mean, he must have known who he was going to call. Now, I will tell you that for one millisecond, as I was going to help him, I thought, I could drink. When I got to his house to help this suffering alcoholic, I figured, being the smart guy that I am, that if I showed him what an alcoholic looked like, he would want to not drink. Now, cunning, baffling, and powerful did not mean much to me until after that experience. But after that experience, I actually got drunk, of course, and to show him. And when I came to, a number of things had happened. Number one, I was terrified. I had to call a VA hospital and I had to lie. Now, I gotta tell you, I have lied to a VA hospital hundreds of times. But being with you guys for 2 weeks screwed up my lying. I hate you for it, because I couldn't lie with impunity anymore. I felt guilty. I mean, I have the flu, and, you know, it's really bad, and I don't want to give it to anybody, and I'll see you later. And I hung up the phone. And I realized that my mind was no longer my friend. That this smart guy, that his mind I had, that had been so wonderful for me for so long, had turned on me as a part of my alcoholism. So what happened was that I freaked. I knew I could stay sober for a day, but I also knew I couldn't stay sober. And I went to the Alano Club in San Francisco, and I sat down with a copy of the Big Book, and I cried. And I read the Big Book, and I cried. And I said, I don't care if I don't have a job. I don't care if I don't ever work again. I don't care if I never have a love again. I got to stay sober. And I don't know how to do it. And I asked a guy who had a third grade education and had been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years. He had been on Skid Row for 30 years. And had been sober for 5 years. Third grade education, he had something I wanted desperately and couldn't get. And I said, what do I do? And he said, sit down and shut the fuck up. Were his exact words. And I did. And I did. And it was at that point that I became willing to go to any lengths. And because I knew that I couldn't do it on my own. There was no question about it. Now, I am here today because of those that came before me. And obviously, I think about my early sponsors and my early influences. My first sponsor was a guy named Les, who had been fired from a night clerk's job at a Tenderloin hotel in San Francisco. And I don't know if you've ever been in a Tenderloin hotel in San Francisco, but they are not the kind of hotels you're going to find in San Clemente. Okay, they are rough, rough places. And what happened to Les was that when he got fired from that Tenderloin hotel, he called Alcoholics Anonymous, and his sponsor took him home. That was the old days, long before rehab. Even I didn't have rehab to go to. I still remember those first few weeks. I would call people up and say, I haven't slept for 3 days. And they'd go, nobody's ever died from lack of sleep. And I go, I didn't mean nobody. I mean, it could be me. You know, and I didn't have a car, because I was terrified of the person that drove when I was in a car driving. Thank God I didn't have to, because there's a lot of buses, and I went to a lot of meetings, and I got Les as a sponsor. And Les would say, get in the car. And I'd say, where are we going? And he said, it doesn't matter, just get in the car. And he was very involved in H&I. Also, he was involved in terrifying me. He would take me to places that like, there's a place called Rio Honda Hospital in San Francisco where all of the dying alcoholics go, and their livers are all the size of Volkswagens. And he would say, hey, let's take a meeting here. And we would take a meeting to this hospital. And, you know, and I'd be going, God, these guys look horrible, you know. And he'd say something like, well, that's the end effects of alcoholism over a few little while. And then we started going to prisons. Now, I'm a weenie, okay? I'll just tell you right off. I'm from Northeast. I lived in Northeast Ohio much of my life. I'd love to think I was tough, but I'm not, okay? I know I'm not. I know tough guys, but I'm not one of them. But what I learned inside of prisons, we went to San Quentin, Tehachapi, Folsom, Soledad. We took AA meetings there. And I used to take an AA meeting into the county jail for the city and county of San Francisco in San Bruno. What a joint, I'm telling you. And I tried to sell, the first time I was there, I tried to sell Alcoholics Anonymous to these convicts. Have I got a deal for you? If you put down that drink and don't pick up a drink, your life's going to change. You know, and they didn't want to have anything to do with me. I learned how to tell the truth about myself and my disease and my alcoholism in prison. And I learned how to do it there because I couldn't lie to them. They had been through too much. Their life was too tough. They wouldn't listen to me if I didn't tell the truth. So, I had more wonderful experiences going into prisons than I can even count. There is great sobriety everywhere you go. And, you know, what I discovered for me was that working with a sponsor and getting involved in the steps and turning my will and life over, that my life started to really change. And I was fortunate. I was asked fairly early on if I wanted to work in alcohol rehab. There was a place in Alta Bates, a friend of mine was opening up as a rehab center. And he said, come on, work for us, you know, work for us. And I realized that I owed everything I had in my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I couldn't imagine anybody not wanting to do that. And I said, no, I'm not going to be able to do that. I have to go find another career. I have to find a career that means something to me. I was working in ultrasound, and I thought maybe that would do something. So I stayed away from that. And I read in the book where it says, restored to sanity. Well, I don't know about the rest of you, but I kept looking around for that sanity. I couldn't remember when I had it in my life. You know, and I discovered that I didn't have to find it in my early life. I have to find it now. And I discovered it now. And my life started to take off in a way that, you know, it's hard for me standing here to even imagine. I will tell you that unlike when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I bought and paid for every piece of clothing on my body, including my shoes. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not have any new clothes. I had not bought anything. People had given me stuff. I'd gotten it from the Salvation Army. You know, I was a kind of a hand-me-down kind of a person. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous restored my sanity to the point where I was far saner than I ever was before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't remember a time when I was as sane as I have become. I have turned my will and life over. I was talking to our shusher tonight, and he asked me if I was afraid, and I said no. And I said if I was going to talk, I'd be afraid. But I don't talk. I haven't talked since the first 10 or 12 times in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I was really nervous and scared and wanted you to like me. I could give a crap if you like me today, okay? As a matter of fact, I was taught that if all the rest of you get drunk tonight, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink tonight, okay? I hope you don't. And I doubt if you will if you're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an unusual place to do it. Let's put it that way. I was thinking earlier today, too, about my identity as a person. I have sometimes said I am an alcoholic among other things. Because when I first got sober, I was so confused that the only thing I knew for a year was that I was an alcoholic. I kept on being afraid that somebody would say, you know, who are you? I'd go, well, I'm an alcoholic. You know, are you a man? Well, I'm an alcoholic. All right, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I didn't know anything but that. Today I do. Today I do. One of the things that I have today in my life is I have the esteem of people both in Alcoholics Anonymous and many people out of Alcoholics Anonymous, who don't know anything about my story, who don't know anything about my alcoholism, who look at me with regard because I tell the truth without being hostile. I'm on time. I take responsibility. I don't try to blame other people. All of those things that I learned from you in Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know how to do those things. I am an extraordinarily selfish person. After 36 years of sobriety, I will tell you right now that what I do is almost always based on the idea that I do it so I don't drink today. I'd love to tell you for some wonderful reason. It's not for some wonderful reason. Just before I got here, somebody in AA called up and said, hey, would you mind picking me up tomorrow morning? Of course I'll pick you up tomorrow morning. What time to go to the meeting? What time? 6:30, I'll be there. I don't even think about it. I don't even think about it. It's all a part of the fact that I don't want to drink today. I don't want to use today. I want to learn how to be a free human being today. My world was so contracted and so small and so narrow before Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to tell you something. I got terrified in AA about expanding my horizons. Okay? I was sharing with somebody earlier tonight that I got a job offer after being in San Francisco, and it was kind of like this. San Francisco is like this cocoon. I was crazy, but believe me, there are other crazy people in San Francisco. Okay? And we, you know, I used to take a meeting to the mental ward in San Francisco Hospital to talk about a fun place. I felt right at home. Okay? So there are a lot of other crazy people in San Francisco, so I felt right at home. I felt very comfortable. I don't like to be comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous. We talk about it. It's supposed to be good. I don't want to challenge myself, but I want to expand my horizons. I got a job offer in San Francisco for about 6 years, and I was kind of Mr. AA, and I had the gift of the gab and all that kind of stuff, and I got this job offer in Tucson, Arizona. I mean, like 15 minutes after I bought an apartment house with my wife. And I said, I'll take it. And part of the reason I wanted to take it was that I wanted to discover whether I really had Alcoholics Anonymous inside me. And that I knew that if I went to a place where nobody knew me, that I would either have to get into Alcoholics Anonymous and make it my own, or I'd get drunk. And obviously, I did get into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did get involved. And like a lot of us, what I did was, I found people that were like me. Crazy, nuts, a little off. And I found them, and we got a meeting together. And I had it in my house. Because I didn't like the other meetings. They were too nice. no offense, but they were too nice. You know? There was a guy last night that was sharing at Charlie Street, who's got 265 days, or 260 days of sobriety after 15 years of trying. It was the most honest, vulnerable, open share I have heard in years. I was so moved by it. You know, and I went up to him and I said, you keep talking like that, you're going to wind up staying here. You know, because that truth becomes like an addiction to me. I don't know about the rest of you, but I need that stuff. I need it. I mean, I got to tell the truth in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't hide behind things. You know, so moved to Arizona, started this meeting. We're doing a meeting at my house, and you know, somebody, we don't have a name. It's not even a group. Somebody says, "What should we call it?" Some guy comes in one day and he says, "Man, I'll tell you what, this has been a dog shit day." And we went, "Ah, that's it. That's the name of the meeting, Dog Shit Reality Group." And that was what. Now I want to tell you that I did not get angry at Alcoholics Anonymous right off the bat. I'm one of those people that got angry later. If you're new and you're angry at Alcoholics Anonymous, keep coming back. Don't drink. Go to meetings. It's good to be angry. My anger took place years after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was at that meeting. And one night, everybody's talking, and I'm sitting behind the couch. And excuse my language, but I said, F all you bastards, you're all full of shit. Alcoholics Anonymous stinks, I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. And I started to tell the truth. That I was frustrated and angry and I didn't know how to deal with my life sober. I've had through a number of times of this. I once spoke at Cedar Sinai, and half of the people in the room were going, "Yeah, right on." The other half were going, "You're crazy. You're full of shit." You know, and I realized I'm telling the truth, and I gotta tell the truth in Alcoholics Anonymous. I gotta tell the truth for less. I gotta tell the truth for Hal. I gotta tell the truth for those guys in prison. I gotta tell the truth for that guy with 265 days. I gotta tell the truth. I cannot tell you that life has been all wonderful in sobriety. It hasn't. I've had some miserable times, and I have cried more in sobriety than I ever cried before. Of course, I've been sober longer than I was even alive when I came to AA. But still, I've had my heart broken in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've married. I've gotten divorced. You know, I've gotten jobs. I've told people to go, you know what, themselves. I have told people I love them. I have worked with other people. I've had wonderful relationships with other people. You know, my heart is so full because of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I am just touched by the fact that hundreds and hundreds of other people, thousands, tens of thousands of people, came before we did and put the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous out in friendship. And that's why we're here. I love getting dressed up to go to a meeting. When they say there was a dress code to speak, I'm like, oh, cool. Because it's all about respect. You know, I'll tell you a funny story. My sponsor, Les, if Les had told me to take off all my clothes and go down Market Street, I would have done it. Okay? Because I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened, but I finally trusted someone. I finally trusted someone enough. He never did, thank God, because I would have done it. But about 2 years after we were working together, 2.5, this friend of his says, well, you know, Les is gay, don't you? I said, what do you mean Les is gay? And he said, well, he wears white shoes all the time. I said, he does? Yeah, he does. So I went to Les and I said, hey, Les, are you gay? And he said, would it make a difference? And I said, well, no. And he said, this isn't a program of sexuality. This is a program of spirituality. You know? And later on, I introduced that man in a meeting once as the first man that I had ever really loved. You know? He's dead now. He passed away. But I carry that man with me wherever I go. And he taught me about Alcoholics Anonymous, about the spirituality, about the spiritual program we have, about how to be of service. I mean, that man dragged me around to more prisons. You know, we would drive to Tehachapi from San Francisco. I don't know if you know that, but that's a long way to go to a meeting. Okay? And I would go, oh, this is great. And he said, where's the money for the gas? Well, I said, you're going anyway. And he said, no. That's not how we do it in Alcoholics Anonymous. We pay our own way. And I was really hurt for a minute, you know. And then I went, well, God, you know, okay. Let's see. You guys want to get out of here early tonight? No, you don't care. I have three wonderful children. My oldest daughter, who's getting married May 1st, is a great friend. She was the one I beat up in a drunken rage. She doesn't remember it, or if she does, she's forgiven me. We love each other completely. She has her own business up in Seattle and tells me everything, as all my kids do. Unfortunately, I might add. There's a part of me that goes, I wouldn't have said that to my father on my deathbed, for God's sakes. How can you tell me that? My middle daughter is the one that's most like me. And she is getting her PhD in New Zealand. And she is the one that's been the biggest challenge because she's the one that's most like me. Thank God she has a Jewish mother, so she doesn't drink a lot. For which I'm grateful. My son is getting his PhD in Michigan, and he is a doll. He's a great kid. Two of my children have never seen me drink. One has. They all seem to be healthy. I don't know why. It must be their mothers, because it couldn't be me. I have repaired most of the relationships in my life, with the exception of some. I had an incident with my sister when she was about 5 and I was about 11. And she basically has never forgiven me for it and won't speak to me and won't speak to my brother. So there are relationships in my life that rupture in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have the vicissitudes of life. Life goes on whether we're drinking or sober. And you know, I just know that I just am so grateful to not have to drink today. Let me think. Oh, I'll tell you about it. I'll tell you about Tim. One of the things that I was taught by example was to make the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous available. And my sponsor told me when I asked him, and I tell other people when they ask me if they would, you know, if I would be their sponsor, he said to me, I am available. And unfortunately, what that means is that I have to do the work. And I had to do the work with my sponsor. He was available. He definitely was available whenever I needed him. But I had to call. You know, he would not call me. As he pointed out one time, you don't have anything I want. Why would I call you? And I thought, you know, that's pretty right on. Tim and I now have had a sponsor-sponsee relationship for 26 years, something like that, where we have shared intimate all of our secrets with each other. We know everything about one another. I like to tell people that the first year or two I talked with Tim, I'd get off the phone after an hour and I'd turn to my significant other and I'd say, I was just on the phone for an hour and I don't have the slightest idea what that person said. And it was true. But I didn't have to have it make sense. What I had to do was I had to be there. Because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. It's about being there. It's about being responsible. It's about standing up. It's about accepting what we are and accepting what other people are. I loved him. He actually can talk now for an hour and I understand everything he says. And that's a change. That's a big change. And it's a big change as a result of my being present, my being available. I am not a patient person, by the way. I'm a very impatient person. People at work, I tell them about that. I work at Hoag Hospital. I do, you know, they've taken me back after retiring. They took me back. They want me there. I don't know about you guys, but there's a part of me that goes, what? What? You don't know me. I mean, but they say they do know me, and they still want me. And I go and I share my experience, strength, and hope. The point is that I have a place that I am respected and regarded. And I never had that when I was drinking. I am very grateful to be here. I'm going to let you all go soon, home soon. Thanks for letting me share.